I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source with the remarkable public thinker George Shialaba, my friend of many years. George reads voraciously and writes awfully well, usually in the form of reviews or essays that get collected in books every few years. He has no specialties, no tenure anywhere, no genius grant, not even a blog. Thinking out loud is not a living for George Shialaba, it's his life. He's one of my ideal public intellectuals. He's also a depressive, like one in every 10 adults in the United States. People who report a persistent struggle with feelings of alienation or sadness or hopelessness. Well into his 60s, George Shialaba set out to track down and then to publish the clinical notes of all the doctors he had seen over nearly 40 years. The Baffler magazine made an article of it this winter, and George said he would be willing to make a conversation of it with me. He's talking here about therapy, drugs, electroshock treatments, and all the while about a philosophical and religious search into life and some of the suffering that seems to be inescapable in his life. In the next 30 minutes or so of our conversation, you'll also hear readings from the notes his doctors made about George.
September 30, 1970. The patient has been in New York City in the graduate school at Columbia, but had a severe obsessive breakdown in functioning, necessitating his dropping out of school. I see him as a very troubled man, and I would venture to say probably sicker than an adjustment reaction of adolescence, more likely borderline personality with obsessive-compulsive features. He is not suicidal, and there are no signs of acute decompensation.
George Shialaba, I'm one of those friends of yours who was fascinated and also grateful for your disclosure of your own clinical notes, the doctors and professionals' notes on your state of mind, depressed most of it, over the last 30, 40 years. Mainly because we all live in the neighborhood of depression, our own or somebody else's, and talking about it does seem a constructive step. But I also wonder why you wanted to put these notes on the record and how you read them, how you would read them as a kind of work of literature.
Well, they're very far from literature, and they're hardly written or composed at all. They're a very distinct form of writing. They're almost a form of anti-writing. It so happens that my current therapist is a teacher of a course in how to write treatment notes. And in the course of talking about this whole project, she mentioned that over the course of her career, 30 or 40 years, the process has changed drastically. It used to be much more freeform, much more wide open, much more candid and unhedged, uninhibited. And over the course of time, as medical liability has become more of a concern, as the whole society has become more litigious, they've become very much more self-protective, understandably, in a way, but also they've shifted and limited the focus not to express what may have struck them or puzzled them, not to set down something in their individual voice just because that's an aspect of being human and being in contact with humans.
But why not, I wonder?
Well, but rather simply to give future clinicians, and in particular emergency room clinicians, something to work with if a crisis happens. So it's, you know, for good reasons and bad, and the same reasons have both good and bad aspects, the notes have become much more narrowly defined in their purpose and more guarded.
August 26, 1981. My assessment is that this man suffers from a rather severe endogenous depression superimposed on a schizoid personality. He describes his mother as having been dominating, although very nervous, and his father as a timid, weak man. Father held an office job and mother was a stitcher. There is one brother who is taking night school courses at Suffolk Community College and works in the Public Works Department. Thus, the patient greatly exceeded the level of the success of his family simply by going to Harvard and doing well there. I wonder whether part of his subsequent decline is attributable to edible fears, which his success represented. He describes having wanted to be a priest from second or third grade, and such a role was highly respected within his community. He currently has fears that his turning away from religion may have been a mistake, and that he could be damned to hell for this.
There's so much formula words, too much diagnostic lingo bingo. I mean, severe endogenous depression superimposed on a schizoid personality. Well, what did the man say? How did he look? What human connection was made? Not to mention all this incredible list of pills you've taken over the years with oxydoxy, whatever.
Yeah.
And nobody at the core of this record seems to know what's working, if anything's working, is anything better than a placebo. So it's all a kind of fantasy. This is a story without a plot, without characters, without hope, in a way.
One of the things I have learned in recent years is that the definition of everything, including success in treatment, has been constrained by, conditioned by, the requirements of insurance companies and hospital administrators and the business side of the profession. So in order to get paid for something, you need to be able to show the people who are shelling out that it works. And they demand quantitative measures, you know, the equivalent of the quarterly report. Mm-hmm. And how do you quantify a long conversation in which a patient gradually sees the outlines of his or her life emerging? If you can't measure it, you can't expect to get paid for it. That's the sad.
Wow. George Chileba, I know you mainly, of course, as a writer of superb cultural commentary across the board, a lot of it literary, a lot of it political. I feel I know you as a friend. If I asked you, not for quantitative measures or not diagnostic and statistical manual terms, George, how are you feeling? Really? How are you, really? How will you describe your scene?
Wittgenstein's last words as he was dying was, "Tell my friends I've had a wonderful life." Now, if you read the biography of Wittgenstein or his letters and diaries, there's a man who suffered, whose sufferings put mine and anyone, others I've read about, you know, in the shade. He suffered excruciating depressions. You know, he didn't say anything frivolous or in vain his whole life. He weighed every word and spoke from a position of enormous intellectual and philosophical integrity and authority. So I think he meant that. And it's always served as an illumination to me.
Is Wittgenstein sort of summing up work for you?
It helps. It helps a lot. It doesn't make the bitter memories any less bitter, but it helps.
Go back to the beginning. The rough outline of your story, as I remember it, is that you grew up a little younger than me, but in East Boston with an Italian accent. You were sort of affirmative action, working class Italian kid at Harvard in the 60s. And then things stopped after fashion. You were active in Opus Dei, a kind of arch Catholic cell, and you got deep into it and then bolted out of it. That seems to have been a turning point. In what sense?
Well, I'm still figuring it out, but I thought from, you know, age 6 or 7 that I wanted to be a priest. I became an altar boy. I was very devout. I didn't, you know, use the naughty words that all the other little working class Italian boys in my schoolyard used, and you know, didn't try to fool around with the girls as they did, eschewed pornography, you know, and just kept myself free of mortal and even venial sin to the extent that I could. And I think the reason for that is in part because my immediate environment, my home and my neighborhood, were very limited, very dull, stifling, not in any active sense that, I mean, my parents were decent people and very conscientious, but they, I mean, mother never completed grammar school, never read a book as far as I know, and my father, I think, finished high school, but that's all, and was an intellectually curious man, but likewise not an educated man. So I think I sensed, without ever being able to formulate it, that there just wasn't enough oxygen in this atmosphere. So I thought first becoming a priest would at least be a way of connecting with a universal organization, a way of leaving home, and a way of taking out a pretty solid insurance policy for eternity, which I still believed in then.
What about Harvard itself, just getting a first-class, expansive, liberating education?
Well, Harvard comes along a little later in the story. First, I checked out the local Franciscan seminary. Not much oxygen in that atmosphere either. So I went on to high school thinking that I would go after high school to the seminary then. And then this recruiter came from Harvard as part of their affirmative action outreach in 1964 or three, and said, "Hey boys, think about it." And so at the same time I met Opus Dei, and they said, "Here's another way of locking up eternity and also being part of a universal crusade and, you know, a totalistic thing to lose yourself in." Hmm. Or to amplify yourself ontologically. So I joined Opus Dei and went to college and thought I'd made the best of both worlds, you know, the best possible. And of course I had, from that standpoint. It was a good education, although I actually wasted a lot of opportunities because I was proselytizing for Opus Dei. Hmm. You know, that wasn't entirely a waste, but at least it did cost me a lot of time studying and even some courses which I couldn't take because too many of the books were on the index of forbidden books.
This whole story reminds me of an article a year or two ago by a marvelous writer and doctor, Siddhartha Mukherjee, the guy who wrote The Emperor of All Maladies, about cancer and about the history of defining cancer. What is it and where does it come from? Is it to be bombarded? Is it to be poisoned? Is it to be cut out? Is it all these evolutions radiated, etc.? And then he did a kind of parallel reflection on the history of defining depression. The basic line was, we don't know what we're talking about. We don't know what this beast is, much less how to treat it with exercise, with prayer, with family, with vitamins, with walking, whatever. Or much less all these other combinations of surgeries and radiation and the rest. What is your metaphor for this illness that you've suffered with for a long time now? What's the big picture?
Well, in the one essay I have written about depression, Message from Room 101, I did hit on a metaphor that seems useful, if not sort of definitive. It's a metaphor of the shock absorber. We're all issued shock absorbers, but some of them work better than others. Mm. And some lives are more full of shocks and stresses than others. So if you have a kind of flimsy shock absorber and you're subjected to unusually heavy stresses, then you crash. Mm. It gives out. The shock absorber is the whole emotional, psychological, immune system, which is partly a matter of diet and partly just physiological health. It's partly your affective network. It's a function of the level of solidarity and security in the society you're lucky or unlucky enough to live in.
And what events in the real world do you think it responds to, including love and partnership and family or weather or where you are or income, all manner of affirmations or lack of it in a person's life?
Well, economic insecurity is a epidemic stress. Since 2008, just a lot of middle-aged, you know, laid-off men and women who haven't been able to restart their work lives have plummeted into pretty severe depressions. I know a couple of them. That's a terrible stress. And then there's illness. And
but I'm wondering about the cultural surround, too. W. H. Auden, I mean, speaking very broadly, but about our Western culture, an Englishman who came to live in America said, now is the age of anxiety. And it's been a great 20th century was a big time for both cancer and anxiety in general. The 21st feels under the same sort of gun. What does this count for all of us, do you think?
Well, I think it counts a lot. You know, every age has its Jeremiahs. You know, Emerson and Thoreau thought that the world was going to hell in the middle of the 19th century and made a pretty convincing case. And Henry Adams probably thought the same thing in the late 19th century. And, you know, but there is a common thread. When each of them saw things that seemed like the most precious cargo of the, you know, of the civilizational caravan being neglected or shouldered aside, when, for example, when Thoreau was asked, wasn't he excited that Maine could now talk to Texas? And he replied, well, yes, but what if Maine has nothing to say to Texas?
September 21, 2005. Assessment on patient's electroconvulsive therapy treatment number 1. I met with George and his brother. I again discussed with him the ECT benefits and risks, with the latter including death, cognitive problems, cardiopulmonary problems, and others. He understood and agreed. Observations during ECT. He tolerated the procedure well. Observations 65 minutes after ECT. He was recovering well, cognitively and physically. October 18, 2005. He's now had about 8 ECT treatments. He's having significant short-term memory problems. He says the agony is gone, but that he feels numb and unmotivated. November 1, 2005. He says for the first time in at least 6 months, quote, I'm all right. His mood is definitely better. He's dressed better and even smiles a bit. He'll be continuing the ECT treatments twice weekly for now.
ECT for electroconvulsive therapy, shock therapy, how is it presented to you and why did you choose it in the end?
Well, it was presented to me as a last resort. In 2005, I had a real corker, the worst depression I've ever had. I was simultaneously writhing. It's funny. I don't mean to sound melodramatic, but, you know, it's possible to be simultaneously writhing in pain and to look from the outside almost totally immobile. I mean, I was pacing compulsively, but I was also lying in bed, unable to get up for long periods. I did make it to work every day, but I, you know, did just enough not to get fired. Nothing's worked. This sometimes works. You want to try it. That's really all the doctor said. And so I did. Yeah, no high pressure, no, you know, I'd seen One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. I had my misgivings.
Again, what's the metaphor? What's happening inside your brain when it takes that charge? It's not chemo, it's not radiation, but it's doing something to the electrons.
Yeah, it's 50 years old, and they still are not sure what it's doing. They say it reboots your circuitry, your emotional circuitry. Now, if you press them, I think they'd shift uneasily from foot to foot.
Works with my laptop.
Right. Yeah, and it works as often or more often than antidepressants on average, or at least it produces, you know, from 8 to 10 point improvements on the Hamilton Diagnostic Scale as often as, so that's, you know, and sometimes it does actually produce dramatic improvements. So something is happening.
George Shalapa, I want you to come back to the religious question because, for one thing, I've sort of been there. I mean, I know roughly the territory. In your case, though, a very, very virtuous young man who wants to live a kind of aggressively, or shall we say militantly, Christ-like life in a disciplined way. And at 2021, in the middle of his Harvard education, he decides, no, that's an illusion. It's all wrong. And you've been in flight from it ever since. In so many of the clinical notes on your case, this is noted as a crucial point of your grown-up state of mind. And it fascinates me.
I have to say that before I actually left the order and the church, I thought it was a great gain rather than a great loss. That is, I thought I had discovered the truth about the universe. And I thought that by leaving, I would be placing myself in the ranks of a great army of liberation, intellectual and political, you know.
Emotional, starting, maybe sexual, who knows?
Yeah, going all the way back to the, you know, the first 17th century philosophers, but especially the philosophes and
the Enlightenment, so to speak.
The Enlightenment, and Mill, and James, and Bertrand Russell, and, you know, all the people I admired. I felt tremendously lucky and proud to be a drop in that great wave of progress and truth. And then when I actually, you know, did it, walked out the door, I found that it had been a kind of drug for me. I'd always thought of it as a safety net or a scaffolding, but I think the reaction I felt was from a formal point of view, that is fantastic agitation and anxiety, a kind of withdrawal reaction from the security of, I was on my own for time and possibly eternity, just in case I happened to be wrong. And, you know, I was terribly, terribly frightened, and I forgot all of the pride and all of the joy and discovery and so on. It just vanished. It evaporated. And for decades after that, mostly what I felt was the withdrawal.
But you know, I hear that very, very sympathetically, and I think I've sort of been through some of it. To lose that promise, to lose the cheerful assurance of the catechism that you and I both grew up in, who made me? God made me. Why did God make me? Because to know him, love him, and serve him in this world, and to be happy with him in the next. That's a pretty nice prospect. Mm. When we give that up, we give up something huge. Emerson's line, belief consists in accepting the affirmations of the soul, unbelief in denying them. It's a painful thing to deny those affirmations and to believe in what we grew up calling a soul. But I'm curious that you have, in a way, found your way back out of childhood into a sophisticated and maybe in some sense skeptical, but new language of embracing those affirmations of the soul and belief. Not necessarily in a dogmatic religion or an explicit personal God, but in something large that means something like it.
Well, like a lot of people, I suppose, I have a real boulabaisse or potpourri of ultimate commitments or, you know, anchoring beliefs And one of them, in my case, is the visionary utopianism of John Ruskin, William Morris, Bertrand Russell, Oscar Wilde. A belief in the abiding solidarity of humankind and the kind of heaven that that will make possible. Then D.H. Lawrence, the paganism of D.H. Lawrence. I think it's probably the most convincing philosophy of life that I know. You know, Lawrence said he was a fearfully religious man, and he said there is eternity, but it's instantaneous. It's vertical rather than extended. Mm. It's the depth of your experience. An experience sufficiently deep is our taste of eternity. Mm. I wish I could say I'm fearfully religious. I've been diverted into political complaining for the last 3.5 decades just because they've been such a bitter, humiliating, you know, disheartening 3.5 decades to live through politically in the United States. In a happier time, I think I would have tried to follow through Lawrence's and other non-theistic religious people's spiritual intuitions.
What is the D.H. Lawrence belief, George, that you embrace?
Well, he was an unsystematic thinker, and he died relatively young, at 45. But let me quote myself. I did the closest I've come, and that I think I could come to explaining Lawrence's pagan philosophy is in an essay in The Modern Predicament. Lawrence believed that the universe and the individual soul were pulsing with mysteries from which men and women were perennially distracted by want or greed or dogma. He thought that beauty, graceful physical movement, unselfconscious emotional directness, and a sense, even an inarticulate sense of connection to the cosmos, however defined, to the sun, to the wilderness, to the rhythms of a craft or the rites of a tribe, were organic necessities of a sane human life. Man has little needs and deeper needs, he wrote. We have fallen into the mistake of living from our little needs till we have almost lost our deeper needs in a sort of madness.
It's so beautiful, and you embrace it. Those are your words as well as his. I wonder, does that not fill a great part of the gap that opened up when you left Opus Dei and the Catholicism of your boyhood?
Well, it's an incomplete belief system, but I'd say it's what has replaced Catholicism for me. You know, I'm not completely over the hill and out to pasture, but my life is, you know, mostly lived. It's largely spent. And, I mean, I'm certainly much, much calmer, much more tranquil, but a good deal of that is simple exhaustion. It's, among other things, exhausting to be depressed, and you know, as with a foreign body inside you, you either reject it or you die from it. And I think I've rejected it, but it's taken a deep toll. So, you know, I wouldn't say that I'm healthy now, but I'd say that I'm free of clinical symptoms.
July 23, 2012. The chief complaint of the patient is, quote, "I have been feeling very depressed," unquote. Mr. Shalaba is a 64-year-old self-described writer and academic coordinator at Harvard who has a 30-year history of major depression. He has had at least 5 to 6 major depressive episodes in his life, the most recent of which started in the spring of this year, following a taper of his Zoloft medication from 200 milligrams to 100 milligrams daily. He was hospitalized about 2 weeks ago in Everett for 3 days, where Ativan was started with some effect on sleep, and Zoloft was increased further to 100 milligrams daily. He continues to have anxiety, does not have suicidal thoughts currently, but has wished in the recent past that he would be able to go to sleep and not wake up. Has many friends and supports here in Boston who reportedly give him hope for the future. Patient does not feel that he needs to be hospitalized at this time, Past medications have included Parnate, Desipramine, Nortriptyline, Effexor XR, Wellbutrin, Adderall, and Strattera. We discussed a goal of decreasing patients' mood, symptoms, and anxiety from 8 out of 10 to at least 5 out of 10 over the next week.
I want to ask a question with a certain urgency, George, just because friends want to know. We all know depressed people. We've lived with depressed people. We know famous depressed people, some of them of huge accomplishment, like, you know, Beethoven, Winston Churchill, and his black dogs of depression. And we all, after Robin Williams took his own life, and we all thought, oh, what might I have said to him? But the real question for people like you who can articulate the state they're in is, what should we know about where you're at? And how should people who love you respond?
One of the things that hurts most about depression is that you don't really believe that it's ever going to go away, get better. It just doesn't seem like something with a plausible cause. And so you can't imagine what the remedy is. So people should tell you, look, eventually everybody gets a little better. You know, some people are still mildly depressed, but, you know, virtually no one is acutely depressed for decades and decades and their whole life. So it'll get a little better and probably a lot better. So hang on.
George Shalaba is a writer and a critic based in Cambridge. His article, titled The Endlessly Examined Life, appears in issue 26 of The Baffler. Special thanks to John Saroof, who voiced the doctor's notes throughout this program. It was produced by Connor Gillies with help from Max Larkin. Our executive producer is Mary McGrath, and I'm Christopher Lighton. Also, one more thing. We're into the last few days of our Kickstarter campaign. If you like what you hear and want to support another year of smart talk about arts, politics, and ideas, chip in what you can at kickstarter.com. Search for Open Source. And thank you.